This is the Tribe and Dish Podcast, talking about NBA news, stats, and fantasy.
You haven't even started yet!
The Tribe and Dish Podcast.
We start right now!
So I feel like this is a bit fitting. You and Kevin were doing, I believe it was a Grizzlies episode.
Mm-hmm.
You guys were debating on whether or not a quesadilla was a sandwich. And I can't remember which side of the coin both of you and Kevin fell on with the debate.
It was opposite. I said it was, but that's only because I also said a hot dog was a sandwich. And he said it wasn't.
Definitely neither are sandwiches. So do you remember when we went to NBA Summer League? I think it was last year, year before. I can't really remember at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We had a few drinks after Summer League was over. We were going out. We were having a lot of fun, and we stopped at this Mexican spot to cap our evening off. And Kevin looks up and he orders himself a cheese quesadilla out of everything on the menu between burritos and tacos and everything.
Right.
He decided he wanted a cheese quesadilla.
Right. Which is fine. I mean, you know, it's fine. It's just a little odd. But yes, he did order a cheese quesadilla. And we totally give him so much shit for that. Like, we don't ever let him forget that.
No. And this place was called Gringo's, where I actually met Victor Oladipo there once a very long time ago. And I'll never forget that moment either. But they have these great double-decker tacos. I guess the reason why we're talking about it is because Cinco de Mayo just happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a huge holiday here in the States for people like to go out and celebrate and have themselves some Cinco de Mayo. So, Justin, what did you celebrate for Cinco de Mayo?
I actually got out of work a little bit early, so I went and bought a bottle of tequila. Margarita mix. And me and the roommates went and hung out by the pool all day and just kind of drank. Although I will say towards the end, started getting a little windy, so it was a little cold. And then like we went inside. But after that, we took an Uber out to, get some tacos.
So you invited me to that. And you're like, man, I got this bottle of tequila and I'm going to go hang out by the pool. You're welcome to come. And I just thought, no.
There's no way I'm going to do that. That's not going to be what I'm going to do.
No, I can't. I'm not the young chap I used to be, you know what I'm saying?
I will say, so, you know, we record our podcast in the morning, and I was thoroughly expecting to be in worse shape than I am now. Like, I woke up, and I was like, oh, wow, this isn't that bad. Okay, we can do this. I expected it to be one of those, oh, Justin's really hungover episodes. He's probably not going to say much and just be, like, in pain. You can kind of hear him groaning in the background.
Well, thankfully, that's not what we're going to get this time. And you are listening to the Drive and Dish NBA podcast. Happy Cinco de Mayo, a post-happy Cinco de Mayo to everybody out there listening. My name is Tim Tompkins. Justin Kuzart, the producer behind the boards, keeping us honest. Kevin Rafuse, he is here, just running a few minutes late. So once we get into the NBA talk, he will be here. But so each week on the show, we like to give you guys a shout-out for leaving us a shout-out. And this week we have one from Clutch Hutch. The title of it is A1 NBA Podcast. I've known Tim since November of last year, discovering his work on NBA Twitter. Since joining the 16 Wins a Ring Network, I've been able to listen to the podcast more consistently. I love the production job and the general rapport between the hosts. Keep it up, boys. Signed, Austin Hutchinson.
He's definitely a friend of the show.
Yeah, we finally had him on for this Bulls episode that we just posted a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've been talking to Austin about having him on, which seems like forever. And it's so rewarding because we've really gotten to know a lot of NBA writers and fans throughout the years of doing the podcast. And to finally have them on the show, it just feels like such a reward.
Yeah, no, I really like it. And it's always, you know, humbling when somebody comes on or, you know, we usually delete we have banter before the episode actually starts. So we'll take that audio out before we post the episode. But a lot of times like, oh my God, love what you guys are doing. It's great. Love the show. And I'm always like, you know, so much more than us. Like, why do you like this? We don't know anything about basketball compared to you. Like, it's always great to hear.
We've been doing this series, what comes next for these teams when they get eliminated from the playoffs. I've been having a lot of fun with it personally. It seems like Kevin and I are kind of taking the reins on that, Justin. I'm sort of wondering, when are we going to get a solo Justin pod?
There has never been a solo Justin pod, I know. Right. I don't know. Maybe we'll get one in the works. I'm very intrigued by the Jazz. So maybe I'll have to get something for the Jazz working because they're one of the teams that I'm very interested in right now.
And so we're trying to get out to NBA Summer League this summer. to go to the Vegas Summer League. We usually cover the Orlando Summer League, but we're trying to get out to the Vegas one this summer.
It's a little more expensive than we were hoping, and we're poor radio people. So if you do love the show and you do want to hear us, you know, get into it, you know, get dirty in Vegas with the other NBA writers and all the NBA players, get some really good interviews out of it. Please support the cause. We have a GoFundMe. You can go to driveadishpodcast.com, and any amount helps.
We just want to thank a couple of people who have helped us get there. Chris Gretz, Nicole Kaiser, Liz Kaiser, Tommy May, and Samantha Graham. Right now, we are almost 10% of the way to our goal.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've been getting value out of the Driving Dish podcast for the last couple of years and you don't mind throwing a couple of dollars in, just go to drivingdishpodcast.com. The link's up there. We'll thank you on the show, and we really do appreciate all of your support.
Tell me something I do not know. Do not know.
Now. If you do not know the present, how can you claim to know the future?
Now on NBA News on the Driving Dish podcast.
We need to know now.
All right, first in your news, it's been reported that the Knicks have received multiple trade calls on Kristaps Porzingis. As you know, he skipped his exit meetings with management to show he was frustrated. In his first two seasons with the Knicks, he's lost 101 games. As everybody knows, Isaiah Thomas has sustained a front tooth injury in Game 1 of the Wizards and Celtics matchup. Thomas did not suffer a fracture or a broken jaw, but he does have a temporary dental bridge put in. Tony Parker has underwent successful surgery on his ruptured quad tendon. This is going to put him out for the rest of the season. Parker has one more season remaining on his current contract with the Spurs. It's rumored that the Knicks and Clippers are going to revisit their trade talks around Carmelo Anthony this offseason. The Knicks would likely need to acquire J.J. Redick in a sign-in trade. Austin Rivers and Wesley Johnson are likely to be included as well. And everyone's talking about it. ESPN is bringing back the True Hoop podcast. The podcast received a ton of support on social media following the announcement that it will not continue, so congrats on bringing that back. And that's your news for this week.
Something.
All right, so we're here to tell you about SeatGeek. NBA playoffs are in full swing right now, so you want to download that SeatGeek app and make sure you get your tickets. And SeatGeek is great because it's always going to let you know whether you're getting the best value because tickets are either green, yellow, or red. Green being the best deal, red obviously being the worst. At the same time, there's not going to be any hidden fees at all. The price you see is the price you're going to pay. There won't be $20 in taxes tacked on at the end, so it's great. Download the SeatGeek app. Type in the tickets that you're looking for, and it's not just NBA. If you're looking for baseball tickets, concert tickets, Broadway tickets, whatever, they are all available on SeatGeek. And type in the promo code DISH. It's real simple, like D-I-S-H, driving dish. You eat off a dish and you'll save $20. We've all used it. It's super legit. Next time you're making a ticket purchase, just go to SeatGeek, download the free app, and type in the promo code DISH, and you'll save $20.
So this is a playoffs episode, and we're going to get into that in a little bit, but there has been some NBA news that's come out this past week with the Atlanta Hawks. And Kevin actually did a Hawks interview that will be coming out later on this week about everything going on with their head coach and their presidency position. And I guess, Kevin, you know, kind of explain to the people what's going on.
Well, for those of people who are just tuning in and haven't been following this, so Mike Budenholzer, Atlanta's coach, is no longer going to serve as president of the team. He's strictly going to focus on coaching. GM Wes Wilcox is not getting fired, but he's being essentially booted from the GM position and being reassigned within the organization. So, you know, obviously two major shakeups there for the Hawks front office. And so I sat down with Eric Yeboa, and who's a huge Hawks fan, host of the A-League podcast. And we actually talked about that a lot and what this means for the Hawks future, what they do in free agency now, who they target in the draft. Because the Hawks are one of those teams that do have a lot of free agents right now, a lot of decisions to be made, too, on how you want to take that team. Do you want to double down on its current roster with Paul Millsap and keep building around that? Or do you want to completely blow it up and start over? That's something we talk about in depth. I don't want to spoil it and give too much away, and that there's no incentive for you to listen to the episode, but stay tuned for that. But some big changes in Hawksland, and I mean, spoiler alert, I think it's a good thing.
Kevin, let me ask you a question. And again, you don't want to give away too much, but talking to Eric, I know that when I did that Bulls episode with Austin Hutchinson, that Austin didn't sound all that optimistic about the Bulls' future. So I'm just wondering if Eric was a bit more optimistic about the Hawks moving forward.
More optimistic than the Bulls, for sure, because I think there's more faith in management. And I think Eric said this represents a step in the right direction. Again, I don't want to get too much into the X's and O's, but I think he's probably more optimistic now after this than he was before this, because, you know, that it allows Budenholzer to coach. It allows them to go out and get a new GM, a new president. You know, I think a new direction's been kind of needed in that franchise for a bit. And we go deep into that and what exactly do with this team and with Paul Millsap, and because they are going to have some big decisions coming up sooner than later, and decide whether they want to embrace this youth movement fully, kind of blow it up and start over, or if you want to, you know, keep Paul Millsap and try to get some surrounding pieces in there and build in a different way.
Free agents are always a really funny thing to me, and not funny, but there comes a point when a lot of these really good players are entering their last long-term contract at like the age of 31, 32.
Yeah.
And that's so scary, really, no matter who you're even if you're talking about like Chris Paul, for example, who's been great, but you know that the last couple of years on that contract are just going to be killer. If you're talking about Paul Millsap, who's getting older, the last couple of years on that contract, Al Horford, the last couple of years on that contract, $30+ million over with the Boston Celtics. If you're a team,
Mike Conley,
right? All of these, like, you don't want a superstar free agent at the age of 31 who you have to give a 5-year max to.
The legacy discount at this point, you know, that was the issue with Dwayne Wade and why the Heat didn't want to pay Wade. It's for better, for worse, and for all he's done for that franchise. By the end of that contract, it's going to kind of look brutal. You know, there's no way around it. These guys, unless you're LeBron James, once you hit 32, 33, 34, that's just the reality of when most NBA players get out of their prime and start to decline. And when you have max money in the way the cap is now, you know, you have to spend that max money wisely. You can't be overpaying for some of these guys.
Well, it's kind of like what they did with, I remember us talking about this with Gortat. Same thing. They gave him 5 years, and we were like, it's really good now because he's leading the team or leading the league in screen assists. But, you know, maybe towards the last two or last year of that contract where he's making a lot of money, it may not be, you know, it may not pan out or look as good as it does now.
So that's funny, Justin, that you bring that up, because I have spent a lot of time over the last couple of days kind of reminiscing. So what Justin's talking about is back when we first started the Drive and Dish podcast. I mean, this was like 3 years ago, and we were talking about that Gortat contract, and we're all like, it's going to look so bad in a couple of years. We're now a couple of years down the road on that contract, and it looks just fine to me.
He's still killing it. He's having a great series.
It's aged better too, and the fact that the cap jumped as well, like the cap jumping really bailed out a lot of questionable contracts. I don't want to say the Gortat contract hasn't aged well, because it has. Gortat's still playing at a pretty high level, but even some of those questionable contracts with ages that we may have railed on a little more in 2014 and 2015, now this massive cap increase goes into place, and all of a sudden, hey, you know what? That bad contract doesn't look so bad after all. Like, we killed the Tristan Thompson contract for how long? We said that they were paying Tristan Thompson all this money to show up for one series. Now, does anyone think the Tristan Thompson contract looks like bad value?
Yeah, I do. I mean, but that being said, it is a very valuable series that Tristan Thompson is showing up for.
Well, yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, if my team were giving Tristan Thompson the contract that he has, I would be pissed. But I do think that Tristan Thompson on the Cavs works.
Well, I think once you're at the top, the way they are, you keep the players around, and it's like also a chemistry thing, you know. So, you know, LeBron James, your top player, like we were saying, was vouching for this guy. So to keep the chemistry together, you guys are making these runs. You pay the extra money to keep them together.
Well, yeah, and to what Tim said earlier, if there's one series you're going to be good in, the finals is a certainly good time. Yep. If there's anything we haven't learned from these playoffs, is that the Cavs and the Warriors absolutely do not care about anyone else other than themselves, and do not care until the finals. The level of nonchalant these two teams have showed this far in this postseason, is honestly impressive. It's like it's almost a race to see who cares less about their opponent.
Well, and so this you bring up a good point, and actually this is one of the questions I had coming into this episode is, you know, the video of LeBron James sitting there spinning the ball in his hand, Ibaka's, you know, in his three-point stance with his hands up, LeBron's spinning it, he does a jab step, fade back three, and drains it. And, you know, LeBron James commented after saying spinning the ball in his hands was merely a basketball play, not a sign of disrespect. It was bait. If Ibaka had reached, I would have put it on the floor. It was a mental thing. Everything I do is mental, which actually I do just want to take that part, that everything I do is mental, and just like use that as a clip or like a little drop for our episode. So I may go back and do that. But I ask you, do you feel like the Cavs are being disrespectful to the Raptors?
Well, I know Tim's got a really passionate answer about this, so I'm gonna let him get his flows off, so I will say this quick. Oh, yeah, the Cavs are definitely disrespecting the Raptors, but I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. You're trying to win the playoffs. The goal is to get to the finals. The Raptors, this is a team that has built themselves on saying we're going all in to try to beat Cleveland. If I'm Cleveland and you see this, the way this team has moved to beat you, you want to assert your dominance, and that's what Cleveland's doing right now. Is LeBron flipping the ball on his hand a little bit disrespectful? Of course, but he's trying to rip these guys' hearts out. This is the NBA playoffs. I don't want to hear any if I'm the Cavaliers and LeBron, I don't want to hear anything about Toronto ever again after these playoffs. This is what you're trying to do. You're trying to destroy these teams. You want your reign to be unquestionable in the East, and LeBron is mental warfare too. If you see a play like that, if you're on the Raptors and you've got LeBron James spinning the ball like he's about to shoot a free throw, and then he splashes a three in the face of the guy that you went out in the trade deadline to get to try and stop LeBron and get over the top and slow this down, what does that say? It's mental warfare, and they're trying to get any advantage they can. And, yeah, the LeBron James and the Cavs are absolutely disrespecting the Raptors. They don't care about the Raptors. They don't care about anyone in the Eastern Conference. Like, let's not make any bones about it. This is a team that when the Hawks were playing – when the Bucks are playing the Raptors, they're openly rooting for the Bucks so they can have extra days off. The Cavs are, of course, they're being disrespectful. If you're a fan of those teams, I get why you're upset about it. But at the same time, if you're the Cavs, this is your competition. You are trying to destroy them.
And it's kind of what Korver was saying. Korver was surprised at how a team goes in, like the Cavs are going in saying, okay, if we can sweep these guys, we'll get a whole week of rest. And I remember Korver's comments being like, that's insane. Like, we're just happy to win when we win. I'm assuming he was referring to when he was with the Hawks.
And that says everything you need to know. That shows how little the Cavs think of the Raptors. That they're going, oh, we don't worry about beating them. We want to sweep them for the extra days off. We know we're going to beat them. Even if we drop a game or two, we're not sweating it. And, you know, we're talking about after game three, LeBron James is going up to Drake saying, where are we going tonight? Margarita's on me. They do not care. And it's amazing. They shouldn't care about this team. You're trying to, if this is a team that's supposed to knock you off, you should be destroying them.
It's fine to be destroying them, but so the what LeBron James did right there with the spinning of the ball, like I found that offensive. The grabbing a beer after making that alley-oop or whatever it was, like that right there was a bit offensive. But I mean, I get your point, Kevin. I think you're right in that sense that if you're the Cavs, this is a mental thing, and you know, maybe you should disrespect the opponent. But I can't agree with that. It doesn't make it a fun watch for me. I mean, I feel I'm really mad at myself for getting so emotionally involved in this series, to be completely honest, because it's been really upsetting. Mm-hmm. You know, the game three, they ended up not having Kyle Lowry for the Raptors, made it really close through three quarters right there. And then, you know, at the end of the third quarter, they had Corey Joseph and Norman Powell both off the floor, and you know, the Cavs went on a run and they ended up, you know, just destroying him in the fourth quarter. And it would have been a much more competitive game had I think the Raptors had Kyle Lowry on the floor. I mean, I think they were like 1 for 13 from three. You know, the Raptors just missing open shots, and you know, the Cavs are shooting like 45%, I think, from behind the arc in this series.
Well, and that was one of the things we talked about when they finished with the Bucks, is we said you got to do better, because even the Bucks shot around 40% from three. And I'm like, look, that's the Bucks. The Cavs are a whole nother monster. If you're letting them hit threes, you know, that's not going to be fun. That is not going to go over well for you. And that's how the Cavs are just going to kind of waltz their way past you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, looking at this series, right? So LeBron James, I have a question for you guys. You know, I'm watching it and I kind of felt over the last couple of seasons, LeBron James is slowing down, but I'm watching him play the series where, you know, he's shooting damn near 50% from behind the arc. He's leading the team in scoring. He's leading the team in minutes. And the way he's playing defense, where he's just essentially running around, you know, playing safety, I guess, is a term in football. But to me, he's playing the best basketball I have ever seen LeBron James play.
It's up there. And I don't even think it's a hot take. I mean, you look at the efficiency of what he's doing it with is the most. And at the same time, we talked about it during the season, career highs in assists, career highs in rebounds. It sounds corny and cliche, but it really is a flip the switch thing with LeBron. And that thing is a true representation of how LeBron feels. I think they're like, we talk about it all the time that he's taken time off during the regular season and he's resting and he's not playing as hard. And it's what's most impressive about this version of LeBron to me, and that he's doing it in this playoffs, is not with the domination that he's doing it, but the fact that he's doing it at age 32 with all these extra miles on it. I mean, we talk about guys that, I mean, LeBron's essentially played the equivalent of two or three extra seasons at this point between all the deep postseason runs and going to the finals all these many times and the two Olympic runs that were sandwiched in there. I mean, the fact that he's still doing it. Like we said, we talk about those earlier contracts earlier in this episode. You hit 31, 32, you start to decline. Here we are at 32, and come for playoffs, LeBron James is, because I'm, to Tim's point, I thought we were going to start to see the cracks in the armor soon. I just think that everybody gets old eventually, things happen, and I have yet to see that with LeBron. I mean, in terms of pure individual effort, there's no one on the floor better than him right now. Well, that's just being reasserted once again.
He's shooting 60% from the field right now, 53% from behind the arc, averaging 36 points a game, 8 rebounds, 5 assists, 2 steals, and a block.
In the Raptors-Cavs matchup, his true shooting percentage right now is 74%. Like game. Remember game 2? He shot 10 for 14, 4 for 6 from 3. But the other thing, okay, and I'm not being a hater, but I'm kind of being a hater a little bit here. He shot 21 free throws. The Raptors as a team shot 19. Like, is there a little bit of a, hey, this is the king, we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt thing going on here?
Well, it's ridiculous. So I was watching the game, game 3, and LeBron picked up his first foul in like the third quarter or something. But there was a play before that where, I can't remember if it was Norman Powell or if it was DeMar DeRozan, where Kevin Love was doing the outlet pass, LeBron way down the court. LeBron pushed DeMar DeRozan out of the way, but DeMar DeRozan got called for a clear path foul, and DeMar DeRozan literally didn't touch LeBron James. LeBron James took his forearm, pushed him away, and then got the clear path, two free throw shots, and then the ball back. I mean, if you're talking about superstar calls, this dude gets every single one of them.
He has a 138 offensive rating against the Raptors and a 101 defensive rating. They gave him a game score for the series of 31.4. Just like, Jesus, that's so good.
So you guys know that every year during the offseason, we head out to NBA Summer League. Well, this year, we're trying to head to Vegas to cover the NBA Summer League for you there to bring you a ton of extra content. Unfortunately, plane tickets for 3 people plus 5 nights hotel rooms is extremely expensive. We have a GoFundMe set up that we would appreciate your support on. If you get any value out of the Drive Dish podcast, even a couple of dollars, it really does help. All the information is on www.driveanddishpodcast.com right at the top of the page. Help send the Drive and Dish podcast out to NBA Summer League.
The guys who don't have an offensive rating in the series that high is DeMar DeRozan. And I want to talk about DeMar DeRozan because this is something that Tim and I just completely disagree on. If DeMar DeRozan's an elite player and a max player and is going to carry this team and be your guy, you have to be able to score more than 5 points in a playoff game. I'm sorry. Great players and elite players find ways to stumble into more than 5 points. And that's always going to be my knock with DeRozan. And I know he's getting doubled, and I know he's getting trapped. But if you put any pressure on DeRozan, his game just becomes so predictable, and you can force him into so many bad shots. I mean, I've never seen quote-unquote elite players vanish quite like that. I mean, 5 points in the 1 point before the 4 in the fourth quarter was on a technical free throw. Like, you can't, like, that's not good enough if you're DeMar DeRozan. That's not good enough if you're the Raptors. You need more out of your best players.
Well, they're paying him to get buckets. So to your point, I agree. I think that game 2 score of the series that he had was unacceptable. That being said, he was trapped. He was doubled 21 times. And the game plan when you were watching the Raptors was, all right, well, every time they trap, every time they double, we're going to move the ball, get it out of DeMar DeRozan's hand, which they wanted to do. We're going to pass it around. We're going to find the open shooter. And so they went with that game plan. The game plan didn't work. They lost the game. You look at DeMar DeRozan in the third game of the series when he was getting doubled and he was getting trapped. He found a way to be really effective in game 3. But I mean, I agree with you. If you're a max player and you are this type of elite talent, that you have to find a way to score.
It's like,
even when they're doing that.
It's and not to butt in on you, Tim, but I'm looking at the stats for the entire playoffs. So this is first round and this round. DeMar DeRozan still number 20th on the points per game list, like behind CJ McCollum, behind Jimmy Butler. Who else? Paul Millsap, Mike Connolly. Like, there's Dennis Schroeder. Like, he's still behind players who haven't played nine games. They've only played six or seven, and in CJ McCollum's case, four.
Well, this being said, so I was thinking about this the other day, and the Cavs had practiced all season long about how they were going to defend the Raptors, specifically in the playoffs. And, mm-hmm. and so
The Warriors in the playoffs. The Cavs practiced all season long about the Warriors, not the Raptors. Come on, man.
All right. Well, we'll agree to disagree on this one, because you look at the way that you look at the way that the Cavs guarded Indiana. You look at the way the Cavs are guarding the Toronto Raptors, where they were trapping every single time that a specific player gets the ball. Now, to your point, Kevin, they aren't going to do that against the Warriors. So we can agree to disagree about how they practiced all season long. But the point is that they hid this defensive game plan all season, and they didn't bring it out at all during the regular season. And then come the postseason, boom, they have it. And I think that there has to be, we have to give Tyronn Lue some credit here on what he was able to keep under wraps mm-hmm. during the regular season just to pull out in the playoffs. It is completely stunning opponents, because I don't think they could do this against the Warriors. I don't think you can trap Steph Curry. I don't think you can trap Kevin Durant in the same way that they're doing to these other opponents. But it is giving them extra rest between series, and it's absolutely stunning everybody that they're playing.
Yeah. Well,
Ty Lue said it too. That's the crazy part, is at the end of the season, Ty Lue said, "Oh, well, I have this defensive scheme that nobody's seen yet. Don't worry about," like, kind of trying to pull the wool over and distract the fact that they lost those last four games and were playing such bad defense. And everyone kind of laughed it off. They're like, "All right, Ty, like, we're not really worried about it, but come on, man, you got a whole defensive scheme that you haven't rolled out." And then, yeah, they just rolled this entire defensive scheme out. So what you guys think? I don't want to get distracted here too quick, but what did you guys think of Ty Lue's comments that the Cavs is the hardest coaching job in the NBA? Do you agree?
I would feel like the Warriors would, just managing all those egos, to be honest with you.
I'm tending to agree, only because I think with the Warriors, there's a genuine worry about how they were working Kevin Durant into the lineup, and they have to appease Steph a little bit. So I think there's still some chemistry issues there. I think the Cavs all like each other and all know how to play together. Now, granted, like, don't get me wrong, I don't want to make that sound like that's a knock at the Warriors. Like, the Warriors are coming together. It's just, I think there's more difficulty this season integrating Kevin Durant into the lineup and keeping Curry happy and keeping all these guys happy and still making sure they're getting their shots when they've been so successful. The Cavs, you don't really have to do anything groundbreaking this year. You're basically running the same things that you've been running for the last 2 years. You've got most of the same personnel. I mean, who new did they add this year? Darren Williams? Are you really worried about integrating Darren Williams into your offense?
Corver?
No, they added some new players, though. I mean, they also added, like, Kyle Korver. Yeah.
Well, and
no like major game, like no earth shatterers, though. There's not another Kyrie Irving or Kevin Love coming into the fold here.
Well,
yeah, no, valid point.
My counter argument to saying I understand why Lou may think it's the hardest coaching thing is, I mean, the Cavs always have a target on their back. You're always going to, you know, the teams, they're going to be on national TV. So the teams that are playing him are going to play their heart out and go, you know, put 110% into it. So I could see what he's talking about. But then on the flip side, I feel like teams do that exact same thing to the Warriors. The Warriors don't have any easy games. You play the Sixers, they're still going to play as freaking hard as they can against the Cavs, as hard as they can against the Warriors. They're on national TV in some cases. So I see why he thinks that. So yeah, I mean, it's probably up there in terms of the hardest coaching job. Maybe it's the hardest. I mean, just from the outside looking in, I would say with the egos, with the target on your back, everyone hates Durant, like, it seems like the Warriors at least would be, you know, you falter a little bit, you're going to be scrutinized for weeks.
Oh, yeah. No, I think the Dubs have a bigger target on their back than the Cavs. And I think the Dubs, and I don't, they wouldn't at first because the Cavs are the defending champions. But when you're the Dubs and you go out and you get Kevin Durant and add him to a 73-win team, you're going to have somebody gunning for you every single time. I mean, that was one of the more bizarre things about this offseason, is that you got an offseason where the Cavs are the defending champions, and it didn't seem like it.
Well, and I do want to talk about the Warriors-Jazz matchup, because it's really intriguing to me. But before we move off the Raptors and the Cavs, maybe you guys don't have an answer to this, because I've been thinking about this for a while, and I don't. DeMar DeRozan, in an interview, said, "I'll give $100 to anybody that can tell me how to stop LeBron James." So, you're trying to get this $100. What would you offer up as advice to DeMar DeRozan on how to potentially stop King James?
I think you stop King James, LeBron. Not to use that King James. That I don't know. That nickname just bothers me. But
he's the god. Pay homage.
He's the
humble. I think LeBron James is one of the top three players of all time. So I really come around on LeBron James. I think he's amazing on and off the court. I think that he's that everything he does is truly respectful and
absolutely
no hate
off the court, especially off the court. I almost respect him more than on the court. What he does for those kids in Akron, that's incredible.
Absolutely. That being said, I think the way that you stop LeBron James is single coverage, in that you stop LeBron James by never doubling, by never leaving the shooters, that the guys that are guarding, for example, the Kyle Korvers and the Channing Frye's and those kind of guys, is that you have to stop the passing lanes for LeBron James and make him score against you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way you can do it. I think that a lot of people they look at the ball, they follow the ball. It's their natural inclination is to, when LeBron James starts heading to the hoop, that they're going to kind of collapse around the basket. And then LeBron James has all these passing lanes with all these shooters on the side, and you can't do that. So in my mind, you don't stop LeBron James. You stop every single person that he can pass it to.
I was also going to say something that's interesting and has been pointed out by a few of our Twitter followers, is that LeBron James' free throw percentage in general throughout a good amount of his career hasn't been great. I wouldn't say 71. Like, he's shooting 71% in the playoffs right now, so I wouldn't even say putting him to the line would help. But that's something interesting to keep in mind with him. Someone I forget who it was pointing out that LeBron James goes and tries to get all these fouls, but he's not that great of a free throw shooter. So it's kind of interesting when he'll go fishing for fouls, but only get maybe half of them to go.
Well, he's shooting 82% in the series.
Yeah, I mean, I still
37 of 45.
Yeah, no, it's been impressive.
And I still think there's incredible value in getting to the line every single time, even if you split. That's a positive offensive contribution, and mm-hmm. you get these guys in foul trouble. So I don't necessarily agree that LeBron James seeking fouls is bad basketball
IQ. No, I agree. I think in the future, maybe once his game starts to regress a little bit, that might be the first spot to expose LeBron. But obviously, right now,
call me in 2026 when that happens.
Okay, fair enough.
Because that's the rate I'm at this point. I don't know when it's going to happen. I thought it was going to happen soon, but it doesn't look like it.
Can't get enough Drive and Dish podcast. Make sure you keep up with us on Twitter. Follow us at Drive and Dish NBA.
If the Raptors only get one win or potentially get swept, would this be a failed season, in your opinion, for the Raptors?
Oh, if you get swept, that's embarrassing. When you went all in, if you get swept, yeah, that's a failure. I don't think there's, like, I didn't think the Cavs were, or the Raptors were going to beat the Cavs, so I don't think that's a failure. I think the Raptors went all in. I think that this was the core they built. This was the quote-unquote best shot they had with this team. I still stand by the Ibaka moves and the PJ Tucker moves. This was the right choice by the Raptors. If they felt this was their year to go all in and knock off the Cavs, do it. Mm-hmm. Like we said, these windows don't come along very often. But if you go all in and get swept, I mean, for better or for worse, that is a failure. I'm not saying the moves are wrong, but when you look at that in a vacuum, that is a colossal failure if you get swept.
I disagree to a certain extent. I mean, I do agree that it's a failure to get swept. And I do agree to your point, Kevin, that you have to go all in when you think it's your opportunity, because to your point, the windows aren't open all that often. But I think it leaves a lot of questions for the offseason. I mean, look, Kyle Lowry, Serge Ibaka, PJ Tucker, I know those three is specifically off the top of my head, that those are going to be free agents at the end of this year. And that if you are looking at it from a management perspective, you can't look at that team and say, we're going to max all these players out, or we're going to bring back all these players and max out our roster specifically on a team that just got swept by the Cavs, because obviously it isn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and with Lowry too, we talk about the age factor. Lowry is going to be on the wrong side of that prime once this max deal goes into place. Do you worry about those last few years of that contract? I mean, Kyle Lowry's been great these last few seasons. I don't want to take away, but that is a concern that you have to when you're the Raptors. You're committing a lot of money to Lowry and DeRozan then at that point. And are you convinced these two, given their playoff history, are going to take you over the top? I'm not necessarily sure. Honestly, I would have probably stuck around with Lowry more than DeRozan. But oh, yeah. You've already committed the money to DeRozan.
Kevin, don't get it twisted, man. You do not appreciate DeMar DeRozan's game, right?
I don't.
No, you don't. You don't like DeMar DeRozan, and that's fine.
I still appreciate his game. Like, I like him. Like, he's fine. I respect that he is a great scorer. I just – and there's something to be said about being the best at the quote-unquote mid-range game and ugly shots. I just don't like guys that thrive off ugly shots. I don't think it's sustainable come playoff time like now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions going forward with the Raptors. I think, yeah, if they don't at least win one game, it's a fail. And I think it's going to look so much worse because it's not, you know, the actual – finals that they're getting out. They're getting out in the second round at this point. So, I mean, it's going to look worse on paper than I think, you know, maybe the season will tell. Another potential sweep possibility in the NBA right now is the Jazz and Warriors. And watching the game, at least game one, Gordon Hayward shot like 18%, like 12% from three. They just absolutely locked him down. Game two, he had a better game. I'll give him that. And I really like Gordon Hayward, so don't this isn't me just bashing him. I asked the question, is the Jazz and Warriors matchup entertaining to you at all, or do you feel like this has really been a snooze fest? And same kind of question, if they get swept by the Warriors, for the Jazz, is this a failed season?
I don't think that, for the record, that either of the Cavs series or the Warriors series have been entertaining as a basketball fan. I think there are things to take away, and I'm not saying it's the worst series of all time, but it's not exactly fun to watch the Warriors and Cavs beat teams that were better or that they are better than.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to answer the second part of that question, is it a failed season for Utah? Absolutely not. If we're talking about Utah, this is a team that's been on the cusp for a while. They got into the playoffs this year. They took the first step. They handled their business and beat the Clippers in the first round. Like, there's nothing wrong with losing to the Warriors. The Jazz are on that level. And to me, if you're the Jazz, the most important thing you've done this season and in this playoff run is not only winning the first round to get that experience under your belt, but you showed Gordon Hayward, who's going to be a free agent, that, hey, this group can win. We can still build with this group. We've had a lot of bad luck with injuries. Rudy Gobert continues to develop. You know, we might be on to something there. That, in reality, is the importance of Utah. Utah, if they lose Hayward, is going to take a massive step backwards, and the future becomes a lot more cloudy. If you look at Gordon Hayward, now you're going to say, well, yeah, you can go to Boston and have fun with LeBron James, or you can hang around here in the West. You know, build on what we have. These guys seem to like playing with each other. Gordon Hayward seems to like Salt Lake City. You know, I know their nightlife has come under a little scrutiny in this series, but no, I think it's encouraging if you're the Jazz. I don't think that the Jazz didn't go all in to win this year. There's nothing wrong with losing to the Warriors.
This series has brought out the question, and I know Gordon Hayward has mentioned it in the past about not wanting to be the number one guy on offense, and it kind of seems like he's been struggling with the Warriors, like I pointed out, and I understand it. It's the Warriors. Like, everyone on that team is really good at locking you down, and he's going up against, like, Kevin Durant, and they've held him to 29% from three in the Warriors-Jazz series, so he's been struggling a bit, and I get it. But I wonder, can Gordon Hayward be the number one option on a team?
I think you'd have to build around him specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, I mean, you know, to your point, I think Gordon Hayward's a great 1B.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon Hayward's one of my favorite small forwards right now, and it's funny because you have a lot of people talking about Paul George, but if you read the comments by NBA execs, a lot of those NBA execs are saying, you know, if we have a small forward that we want to target, it's going to be
Gordon Hayward
over Paul George, because he's a better all-around player. He's a better all-around teammate. And by saying player, they're talking about teammate, is that what he gives to a team is, you know, it's something that you don't have to deal with, really, with Paul George. I think Gordon Hayward's been really good in this series, but, you know, to your point, I don't necessarily think he can be a 1A, but they've also gotten a lot out of Rodney Hood.
Mm-hmm.
At times. You know, they are a piece away. To me, when I look at this team, you know, and you look at Derek Favors in the series so far, you know, he's averaging what, like 4 points.
Mm-hmm.
they need a power forward. And so I'm looking at Ibaka over there in the East. And, you know, I think if you're the Jazz and you can bring back both Hayward, both Hill, who, by the way, they didn't have Hill in that third game, but, you know, it seems to me that the position that they need to upgrade the most is going to be a power forward. And if they can get a really good power forward, I think, you know, we're looking at maybe a contender at some point. But
what about Blake Griffin?
So there's so many questions with, you know, it's funny. So you're looking at both Blake Griffin and Gordon Hayward, same draft class. I think Hayward went ninth or something. Blake Griffin went first. You look at Blake Griffin in the playoffs, so he's always got some sort of injury, whether that's a toe or the hamstring. You look at Hayward, you know, who would you rather roll with through the playoffs if you're a team that has to give out a max contract to?
I almost asked the same question with Paul George, although I will say Paul George's playoff history much better than Hayward, and I would also argue Griffin, but you know, they're all about the same age.
Well, I mean, if Griffin's healthy, Griffin is a better player. Like, I don't want to start getting too hot takey here, but that injury factor is real. I mean, it happened almost every single year, so you can't discount that. I mean, if you're going for who do I think is going to be on the court more, it's going to be Hayward every single time. Mm-hmm. But I think Blake Griffin is a true number one option if he's healthy. It's just that, unfortunately, for better or for worse, it's been a major if. And that's been, you know, it's been one of the more unfortunate storylines of the NBA over the last few seasons. I think Blake would be a great fit in Utah. To Tim's point, I agree. I think Derek Favors is going to want a lot of money too, is the other thing. He's going to be a free agent. If you're Utah, do you want to commit that amount of money to Derek Favors, or do you want to keep going younger? And I think, you know, part of Gobert's development this season was, he doesn't have much of an offensive game, but he's among the league's best in terms of efficiency and percentages around the rim. He, you know, there is a skill in finishing every shot around the rim every single time. And if they could get more of an offensive development out of Gobert, like we saw this year, you know, you pair that with him and Hayward, you are one piece away from contending, in my opinion. I mean, I had the Jazz on that. The Jazz are the lowest of that second level of Western teams. Like, you've got the Warriors, who are clearly number one, and then you've got the Spurs and the Rockets who are behind. And then I think the Jazz are in that Spurs Rockets tier, not quite to their level yet, but I think they're really close to that level.
When I was, to your point, looking at Rudy Gobert, he's shooting a true shooting percentage of 65, effective field goal of 68. His offensive rating against the Warriors right now in the playoffs is 21, or a 121, and his defensive is 110. So yeah, he's been, you know, it's been interesting. One of the things they pointed out is the Warriors, pretty much what they did was, they would run out a small ball lineup of all shooters, which would then bring Gobert out to the 3-point line. And then once Gobert's out at the 3-point line,
saw what happens.
It's not going to help. So pretty much what's been kind of interesting in Quinn Snyder's, a nod to Quinn Snyder, what they've done is when JaVale McGee or when Iggy is out on the court, they put Gobert on them and they say, fine, shoot it. I don't care where you are, shoot it. You're going to be wide open. And Iggy obviously having some struggles from three in general and also shooting in general. So it's kind of worked a little bit. It got them back in the game. I believe it was game two where they kind of brought it back. They were down by like 30. They brought it back within six. I don't know if that's the Warriors just, you know, kind of easing up on the gas pedal or the game plan actually working. But it's something interesting to look for Gobert specifically going forward and how teams are going to game plan against him.
Well, I mean, to that point, though, is you have a player that's so good that the teams have to make adjustments to try and get out of the game.
Right.
No matter who you're looking at. Look at, the way that the Cavs game planned against DeMar DeRozan. Mm-hmm. You take one of the best players on the team and you find a way to get him out. And that's what makes the other team so damn good, is they can find a way to make your best player, one of your best players, completely ineffective in the court. And that's what makes the Warriors and the Cavs just light years better than everybody else.
I know. Well, that's the problem is with them is they have so many players that you do game plan for one, and then there's three others that just end you.
Right.
They're deep. They have top options. We talk about Utah. I mean, we say Hayward is maybe a 1B, and you throw Gobert in there as well. But Cleveland's got, and Golden State have that only to a better extent. And then, oh, by the way, they have all the depth pieces needed to surround those guys. Like, that's the other thing about the Cavs and the Warriors. It's not like they're just winning because KD, Steph, and Draymond and then LeBron, Kevin Love, and Kyrie are going off every single night. They have games like that, but they're getting solid bench contributions every time. All of those role players are extremely important to that success. This isn't top heavy by any means. This isn't the first year or the second year of that Miami Heat team where they're running out Joel Anthony and the corpse of Mike Bibby and all these just veteran guys that they can find and scrounge up. They're legitimately talented role players on both of these rosters.
Oh, the deepness of this. So, you know, I'm watching the Raptors-Cavs series, and the Cavs are going deep into their bench, bringing off their 12th guy, you know, and it's Kyle Korver. And I'm just like, Jesus Christ. Like, no matter no matter how deep you go, there's just another player that's like, oh, my God.
To be fair, with Kyle Korver, his shot hasn't been great against the Raptors.
Yeah, well, he hit three threes in a row that really turned the scale of game three. So,
right.
You know, and then, you know, to Kevin's point, the night before you had Channing Frye who went off for 20 that really completely eradicated Jonas Valanciunas JV on the court. So, mm-hmm. And if you're talking about the Warriors, I mean, these teams, they're just deep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so Justin made a great meme the other day, only because we brought it up a little bit ago with Gobert and with Bradley Beal's flop. And then he put it to Shooting Stars and did one of those memes. And I'm like, oh, man, Justin's got it. He's the king. And then somebody took Gobert with that dancing meme with Steph and put him into all sorts of, like, tangos and stuff. And I was just like, oh, the internet's undefeated. It was so rude.
That
is so rude. And, like, there's nothing you can do if you're Rudy Gobert. And obviously he's a good enough player. But, oh, my God, that was so disrespectful.
Let me ask you guys a question. Is basketball, and I have to ask this because I don't follow all the other sports on Twitter, but is basketball Twitter just like light years better than every other sport?
Yes.
Yes.
It's the short version.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. One, I think that basketball's fan base is a lot younger these days, and I think they target to a group of people who really use Twitter. I also think we're seeing the NBA on the rise compared to other sports in America. So I think there are more people talking about it. So I think it's a more global conversation. I think that the NBA has done a really good job of becoming digital and embracing their Twitter followers and allowing highlights to be available and allowing people to vine their highlights and all those other little things and getting in on the blog game. So, I mean, yeah, the NBA... Because the other sports Twitters are different. Like, I don't really, and forgive me if I'm wrong, baseball fans, but I don't necessarily know that MLB Twitter exists. NFL Twitter, I mean, the thing is with NFL is everybody watches it. So it's not really as niche as basketball Twitter is. And NHL is like that, but NHL is just, the impact of the NHL isn't as high as the NBA. So the NHL is a lot smaller, more niche version of basketball Twitter. But basketball Twitter, I mean, you've got things on basketball Twitter that go viral and that legitimately get talked about by the players and stuff like that. Like, the NBA has done a really good job just in general of outreach around the globe, online. You know, the NBA is, there's a reason the NBA is blowing up the way it is. And it was funny, this is on something different, but to a conversation I had the other day, you know, people ask all the time, well, you know, the Warriors and the Cavs are going to go to the NBA Finals. So doesn't that make for a bad league? And I think it's a bit disappointing that it's so preordained. But when you have two teams that are that awesome and you know are going to give you a great matchup, it kind of gets rid of that. And B, you know, there's just more talent in the league than I think there's ever been. I mean, if you look at the NBA from 1 to 30, we go from Golden State and Cleveland all the way down to Philly, Orlando, Brooklyn, Phoenix, all these teams towards the bottom, and there's somebody on each of these teams that I'm going to tune into every night. If I'm watching Phoenix, Devin Booker might go for 70. If I'm watching the Sixers, Joel Embiid might do something if, Lord willing, he's on the court. If you know, there's things to do. If I'm watching Denver almost made the playoffs this year, so I don't want to say they're a bad team, but you could watch a guy like Jokic. There's something to tune into on every single team every night. I don't necessarily think in the past we've had that. You would genuinely have these bad teams who you would just get the brains beat out of them every single night, and there wouldn't be anything redeeming. At least now there's something redeeming when you take the time to watch teams that aren't as good.
I would also say I think NBA Twitter is the only one to have an after show or a Twitter-specific Periscope show where guys actually sit down and do a live on Twitter. I don't know if many other sports are doing that specifically, although I will say the NFL was streaming football games on Twitter, which I thought was pretty cool.
That's something they're going to be doing more.
Yeah.
And that's something like Twitter is trying to make itself more relevant by doing that. But speaking to the NBA Twitter, are you talking about the one with Nate Duncan, Danny LaRue? Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to become more common, more than just, you know, there's one or two people doing it. I think that'll get kind of use.
Well, they're doing two where they basically pay for a subscription. They're doing Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
And Derek Bodner is doing that too, the big Sixers writer. And he basically, after he got laid off at Philly.com, he basically said, you know what, let's give it a shot. Who will pay the subscription fee? And I'll write. You'll get mm-hmm. access to all my content. And it works. And it goes back to our point that we talked about last week. Pay for content. If you like content, support it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's simple like that. You know, we provide, and a lot of podcasts provide free content, which is great. And appreciate all the free things. But like for some of these veteran guys who it really is a living force, support it.
We want your voice on the Drive and Dish NBA podcast. If you have questions, NBA related, or you have a comment about today's show, leave us a voicemail, 904-281-8141. Again, that's a 904-281-8141. And we'll feature your voice on the next episode of the Drive and Dish podcast.
And I wanted to get back to a point Tim had brought up. He mentioned Isaiah Thomas, Kevin, I think it was you. It makes me question, because if you look at the three games the Wizards and Celtics have played, and personally, I think this has been the most entertaining matchup that's been going on right now. Isaiah Thomas game one, 33 points. Isaiah Thomas game two, 53 points. Game three, John Wall finally was the points leader in the game for 24. I asked the question, out of the Thomas-Wall matchup, if you had to pick one who's having a better series, who's having a better series? Technically, if you look at it, Boston is, you know, it's 2-1. Although Wall, when you look at them compared stat by stat in the playoffs, Wall leads in more categories.
Yeah, I'm really conflicted about this. So I think that Isaiah Thomas has been amazing. You also watch Isaiah Thomas wherever they tried to hide him, mm-hmm. whether that's on, you know, Oubre, if they try and hide him on Beal, which is never, you know, a good idea. But if they try and hide him on Porter, for example, you know, he gets demolished. And mm-hmm. so everything that Isaiah Thomas is giving you offensively, to a certain extent, is being taken away defensively. That being said, I think John Wall has been really good, but I'm watching John Wall guard Isaiah Thomas. And when he gets beat off a screen or whatever, when he's trying to go around the screen and he doesn't make it, he just gives up.
Yeah.
And on the defensive end, I've been really disappointed by John Wall, but I think John Wall's been amazing too. I mean, look at how important he is. The minute that he is off the court, you know,
it's bad. It's really bad.
The Wizards can't score. But, you know, that being said, in game three, they did get a lot more out of Brandon Jennings. He was playing a little bit better. I think both have had really good series. There's been parts of both their games that I've been disappointed with, though.
Before you go, I think this is pretty funny. The out of the just main stats, rebound, assist, steal, block, points. Like I said, John Wall leads in assists with 11, steals with 1.8, blocks with 1.1. Although I will say John Wall has had some monster blocks this series. He's also leading in points with 29. The one category that Isaiah Thomas leads in is rebounds, and that's just so weird to me because he's so short.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think they've been close to equal. I think Isaiah Thomas has probably had a better series. I mean, just you look at the first two games, especially game two. I mean, he won them game two. There's no way around it. He closed that game out. He was Mr. Fourth Quarter again.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've both been about equal, though. I think, to Tim's point, the Wizards are significantly worse when John Wall is not on the floor. It's very noticeable. At the same time, in game three, they really did a good job of limiting IT. So, you know, I think they both had good series. I'm taking IT probably for the series. I think John Wall is the better player. But that's been a fun series. I don't know if it's been I mean, Rockets Spurs game three was really good.
Mm-hmm.
The first two were more blowouts, so that takes away. But I found that series to be incredibly entertaining. But this is a good one, too. I mean, game three was just a blowout, so it was kind of disappointing. But game two was one of the better games of the playoffs. The Wiz home court advantage is so real, and that's something that I feel like we haven't talked about. But the Wiz home court advantage, they're one of the best in the league, and they came back to Washington and just smacked the Celtics.
Well, both those first games were close, and they lost off of a couple of possessions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean the Wiz had a chance to win that second game. John Wall had a look, and it just you didn't get it. And they fell in overtime, but they were they had chances.
And the Markieff Morris injury that was a big one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Game one, him going out. They had no depth. But the Celtics, that changed that game. The Celtics started eating them alive down low as soon as Morris got out of that game, and the Wiz just don't have the depth of power forward.
Once they got Jan Mahimi back, too, I think that was really big for him.
It's kind of a funny because we were all watching, but we were all separate, so we were texting about that game, and when Morris went down, I texted Tim, and I was like, that looks exactly like what happened when we were playing. I landed on your foot, and I rolled it. And as I'm watching it, Morris just gets up and kind of limps off. And, like, I was just thinking, I was like, I did not even try to walk on my foot for, like, 3 weeks.
I think he shot a free throw after that.
Yeah.
Also, just a reminder as we take a look, because I know we're coming towards the end of this episode, but just since you said free throw, I can't believe you took that. It reminded me that Kobe tore his Achilles and then shot two free throws and made them both.
So you're saying you think the Rockets Spurs series might have been more or is more exciting than the Wizards and Celtics?
Yeah, I'm more intrigued by that one just because I think there's more star power in that series. Mm-hmm. I like watching Kawhi. I like watching James Harden. The games haven't been quite as entertaining. Because game one, Houston just blew them out of the water. Their shooters couldn't miss. Game two, San Antonio came back and pretty much blew Houston out of the water. Game three was a bit closer. The Rockets bench was just terrible in game three. I mean, Ryan Anderson had 2 points, both of them off free throws. Lou Williams couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. Eric Gordon was cold. So it's tough to get a win when you don't have those contributions. But I just think the star power is better, though. I will say the rivalry element of Boston versus Washington is extremely entertaining. I mean, it's only going to get chippier. I mean, you talk about Oubre and talk about Kelly Olynyk. These two teams do not like each other.
I was going to ask you what your thoughts on that little Kelly on Kelly violence.
Olynyk's been low key a dirty player. Oubre's got to control himself better and not go after him. But I get it. He set a hard screen. Oubre took offense to it, and if you watch it in slow mo, there was an elbow out. Mm-hmm. I don't think Olynyk was intentionally trying to elbow Oubre in the head necessarily, but if you see that elbow going around a screen, you may think otherwise, and Oubre clearly took offense to it. A lot of players take offense with what Kelly Olynyk does, so it's not exactly like, there's starting to be a little bit of a trend here.
The Oubre push, though, that was the second really hard screen that Olynyk had set. Mm-hmm. So while he was pissed about that screen, he was pissed about the screen just prior to that, too.
Right.
So that's the one is what really set him off. But I mean, that Washington bench is not deep enough where you can really lose a quality role player.
Right.
So he does have to control himself a bit better. But yeah, those two teams, man, they do not like each other. And like Markieff Morris saying that Al Horford did that on purpose. Listen, dude, no, he didn't.
Al Horford is not the one I'm going to label as the quote unquote dirty player in that series. I feel like Al Horford barely talks, let alone is like going to go out there and be trash talking and chirping at people.
In that video that I made the shooting star meme with Beal's flop. At the end of it, the clip that I did take at the very end, it shows Horford going over to Beal and he's clapping and he goes, good acting. And I was just like, oh, God, like he's like congratulating him.
Well, you got to give Bradley Beal credit. He really put his body on the line out there. Like he leaped face first. I feel like you could have turned that into a sliding in the DM meme, too, which has got me thinking now. So
I also turned that into a Nike logo. On Twitter, by the way, in case you want to see that.
I got to go see that. Oh, my God. I didn't know that. That's hysterical.
It's a good one. But I would also like to point out, at least we haven't I don't want to get too much into the because we're running out of time, too much into the Spurs and Rockets series. But Paul Gasol has been huge for them. I mean, he had 13 rebounds in game two, averaging 9.3 rebounds. Not much on the point ends, but I mean, when you have Aldridge down there who's only getting about 7 rebounds and from our Facebook reaction to who's having the worst series, a lot of people saying it's Aldridge, Paul Gasol has really stepped in at 36 years old and playing, 82 minutes total in this Rockets-Spurs series and really stepped up.
I mean, LaMarcus Aldridge stepped up in the third game. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, people are right. LaMarcus Aldridge has to be a really solid 1B for that team. He can't just disappear. I thought in the third game of the series, though, is that what we'd been seeing prior to that was a lot of ISO with Kawhi Leonard. I didn't see them running a lot for LaMarcus Aldridge. You know, LaMarcus Aldridge is really known for his pick and pop game, and they weren't running a lot of that. He wasn't really getting a lot of touches. It looks like he had just kind of been taken out of the offense completely. And you know, the third game, they were running more pick and pop for him. He was getting more shots, and he was really effective. But yeah, I mean, LaMarcus Aldridge, if the Spurs are going to do well, has to be a better player for them.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's been getting a lot of flack. So I think I'm sure it's good for his confidence after the way he's been kind of their whipping boy to really get going in game three. We'll see if that propels him into a stronger finish of this series.
The last question I have is about their third highest scorer in the playoffs at 34 years old, getting injured, Tony Parker. My question being, are you worried about how the Spurs can handle losing Tony Parker, because it's a quad injury and he just went under surgery and he's out, like he's not coming back?
Well, you worry about it a little bit because Parker had, you know, Parker stepped up for them in the playoffs, and I think he was giving them some quality minutes, and it allows you to bring Patty Mills off the bench so you can kind of stagger their minutes and spread that out a little bit. I mean, again, this is just more of a depth thing to me than anything else. I don't want to downplay Tony Parker's contributions, but I think in the grand scheme of things, losing that point guard depth is the most important. You know, when these guys get into the third quarter and you start running your bench units and you're not being able to put a guy like Patty Mills out there who thrives in an off the bench role because you're having to give him more minutes because Parker's out, you know, it takes away. And I worry about the depth at the Spurs point guard spot.
The effectiveness of their games is going to show, in my opinion. Tony Parker was 11 for 22 field goal attempts and only 3 for 4 from 3. So he was 50% field goal and 75% from 3. Compared to Patty, who's been letting it ride, he's 10 for 26 field goal attempts, and that's a 38% and 4 for 16, 25% from 3. So I think that could be an interesting spot to see, because Patty Mills, obviously, the guy who's going to step in.
Well, you know, and they started Murray and kept Patty Mills off the bench, which I thought was kind of an interesting choice on Pop's end. Because you can bring Patty Mills and have him start, but then you're messing up the starters as well as the bench. So he opted to just mess up one of those units. But I mean, you know, Murray's basically out there when he's playing is to guard, you know, James Harden and such. But you do have to worry, like, going if they do make it past this series, I'm so tired of injury, man. I want to see the best of every team possible.
Right. And
I agree.
And kind of not seeing the best, Manu Ginobili has been kind of, do you think this is the last year? Do you think he's going to retire soon? Because, I mean, he's shooting 29% field goal, 16% from three. I mean, it hasn't been a great playoffs for him. Playing about 46 minutes. He also made a comment, I guess these are going to be the first games in the playoffs he's going to play without Tony Parker by his side, which was kind of interesting to me.
That's crazy. That really is an incredible stat. I do think this is it for Manu. I don't think I was surprised that he didn't go out when Timmy went out. Honestly, I kind of figured they'd go out as a package deal. But I think this is it for Manu. I think TP is interesting now because he does have a history of injuries. Multiple knee injuries over the years. This is obviously the latest addition. Thankfully, it's not worse. I mean, it's his quad tendon. It's not ACL. It's not MCL, anything like that. So you wonder, I mean, he's getting up there in age too. So you wonder how many more he's got.
Thank you guys so very much for listening to this episode of the Drive and Dish podcast. If you haven't done so yet, do us a favor. Tell a friend about the show. If you have a friend that likes the NBA, tell them about the Drive and Dish podcast. Also, Kevin's going to be dropping a Hawks midweek out there. What comes next for the Hawks? That's going to drop this coming Wednesday.
And please follow us on all things social media. You can stay up to date with us on our episodes we're dropping and kind of just talk NBA in general. You can find all the shows at Drive and Dish podcast, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you support the show, please support our sponsor, SeatGeek. You can download the app and put in the promo code DISH and you'll save yourself $20 off your first purchase.
That's right. And don't forget about the GoFundMe, guys. Go to driveanddishpodcast.com. Your support is greatly appreciated to get us out to NBA Summer League.
I think we've done enough dancing for today. So why don't we dance Wednesday?
See you, star side.
Okay, well, I'm out of here.
Get in the hole.
Da, 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 da. Hey! Da, 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 da. Da, 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 da. Hey!
Let's go while we're young.
All right. I think they get the point.
Ha 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 ha